Bankruptcy.
Buy.
Corporation.
Unfortunately.
Present.
Free.
Culture.
As.
In.
Prohibition.
Beer.
Question.
Wired.
Lesson.
But.
Wired moderator Dave Zeroga.
Forbes magazine just ran a review of their books on Portuguese that I've come across. And in addition to calling it an inflammatory new screed, the reviewer also suggests that it should be titled Freeloader Culture, a Manifesto for Stealing Intellectual Property. Now, I'm not sure if you really read it or how much of it you understood. But nonetheless, it demonstrates that a lot of people are sort of missing the point, that they see this as an issue about theft and the protection of intellectual property. How do we get past that? How do we make people see that there is more to this than just losing money?
You know, I don't know. It's as if there's one thing we learned from the internet, that was binary thinking. It's either for property or you're against. And so anybody who says, you know, maybe the system of regulation we call intellectual property has gone too far is somebody who's opposed to intellectual property. That's the way the debate is framed. So the puzzling thing to me is, for somebody with a sense that they reviewed the book, if you read the book, the whole one big chunk of the book is trying to demonstrate how if you think what I'm calling for is a freeloader culture, then the fact is for 186 of the last 203 years, we lived under a freeloader culture.
Damn.
Straight.
I mean, I would love the system of intellectual property regulation that Richard Nixon lived under. How radical can that be? But the point is, in the last 30 years, we've seen a radical shift in the way the law regulates this creative activity. And that radical shift is something we don't even perceive, because when it started, in some important sense, it didn't matter. But now the internet is here in a way that makes it so that real potential is being distorted. Now it matters. And in this context, it's, you know, I've been struggling for 5 years to find a way to get people to recognize that you can be for intellectual property, as I am, and for copyright, as I certainly am, but also believe the system goes too far. Is a free culture that I want, not an anarchy, just like it's a free society that one wants, not a society where there are no rules. But in a free society and in a free culture, there's limits to the extent of regulation that the government imposed rules impose, and we should recognize and seek those limits and that balance.
And you know, obviously a lot of this debate is about copyright, but some of your book, you know, very large part of intellectual property is through patents. And in the world of science and technology, patents are granted to a creator for a period of 20 years, 20 years in fact. Yet, under the Sonny Bono Copyright Extension Act, the creators are given 95 years of protection.
That is crazy.
What's Congress's judgment here? How do we go from 14 years to 95, yes, in the, you know, for copyrights and for patents we've saved at 2 decades.
Lobbyist dollar.
What's Congress's judgment, Councilor? They're assuming a fact, not an evidence. I mean, it is extraordinary because copyrights and patents both started at the same length, right? Essentially the same length. And initially, both of them had very important set of formalities that are associated with them. So you have to register your copyright to get the benefit of it. You have to renew your copyright if you want to get the maximum return. You had to mark your work with a funny little C. You had to deposit a copy with the Library of Congress. All of those were things you had to do to get the benefit of the law. And patents, too, had a series of formalities associated with them. And that set up a system where the people who got the benefit of copyright protection were, in some sense, people who needed it. Made sense that they were protecting their commercial work against exploitation by others, and this was the tools, these were the set of tools to protect it. But in the beginning of the last century, these systems became out of whack, and largely because people who get the benefit of patents typically also pay for patents. producers who patent inventions also have to license inventions that they are using in their production. So there was not as much an incentive to become crazy in the context of patents. But in the context of copyrights, as the media became more and more concentrated and their separation between the creator and the public became stronger, then we got more and more extreme in the context of copyright. But again, I don't think there was any problem in the system until the radical change in 1976. And after 1976, you no longer have to register a copyright, you no longer have to renew it, you no longer have to mark it, you no longer have to deposit anything with Congress. So that means that there is no simple way to know even what's owned by anybody. And there's no way to know what's in the public domain. There's no simple way to know it, which means the only way you can use and rebuild culture is to seek out a potential owner, whoever that might be, and ask permission first.
In the case of patents, you know, if we consider a newly discovered drug, there'll be a monopoly given to the drug company, and then it, after 20 years is up, it becomes a generic drug, and there's a real benefit to consumers, and there's you know, you can clearly see the harm in giving a 95-year monopoly to the inventor of this new drug. But where's the harm in granting a 95-year copyright to an individual?
Yeah, so for most of our history, I would say there probably wasn't much harm at all. Because before the internet, we published a book, most of the books, 98% of the books from 1923 to 1925, 98% of the books are no longer in print, they're out of print. But they continue to live in libraries. And when you use a book and read it, you don't commit a copyright infringement because you haven't copied anything when you read it. When you loan it to somebody, you haven't committed a copyright infringement because loaning doesn't produce a copy. When I buy it from somebody, I don't commit a copyright infringement because buying and selling does not produce a copy. All of these ordinary uses of the text, of the book, were free of copyright regulation for most of the history of our republic. So the fact that the term went on forever really, in some sense, wasn't so burdensome because if a book continued to be valuable enough to be in print, you could find out who the copyright owner was, and libraries could take care of the books independent of that. But when you move into the digital age, and you start imagining that very same book on the internet, absolutely everything you do with it produces a copy. When you read it, it produces a copy. When you give it to somebody, it produces a copy. When you loan it, or you sell it, it produces a copy. So the point is, every act of using the book in the context of the digital network produces an event that copyright law purportedly has to regulate. Now, that means that we've got to begin to think about how to clear permissions for all of these uses in the context of the digital network that we never had to think about in the context before the digital network. And that's the way in which the system has become out of touch with what the real function of copyright law is supposed to be. So it's all, you know, I really think but for the internet there would be other things to worry about. Because of the internet, there's this particular problem.
And because of the internet, then, I mean, sort of just want to throw your hands up in the air, then, okay, so every time I use the digital technology, I'm making a copy of something, so therefore I'm automatically, I guess, violating someone's copyright. And so the question then becomes, can you ever protect someone's creative content? Can you ever give them copyright protection in the digital age?
Right, so then the question is, what's the way to give them protection?
Yeah.
And the old model was give them protection by giving them absolute control over copies. And I think for a lot of forms of media, that might continue to be the appropriate way to do it. But the point is to recognize that there are other ways of guaranteeing that artists get paid. Right? And we have created these other ways historically. So radio plays music without physically trying to control the number of copies of radio waves that are going out there in the world somehow. They pay for the music through some sampling system that determines who's playing what, and then they pay it on the basis of a licensing system that was set up voluntarily by organizations that originally owned the rights. In the context of music, the recording industry has historically fundamentally fought to protect another kind of compulsory license. This is the right to cover someone else's song. So when the Beatles record a song, once they record a song, another musician has the right to record that song, whether the Beatles approve it or not, so long as they pay a license set by the statute. And that was a way to assure that lots of follow-on creators could build on top of music without there being too much control or restriction on the ability to create subsequent work. Now there too, it's not perfectly controlling the right to get access to this resource. It's controlling it in a different way. And there have been many, I think, sensible proposals in the context of the internet about how to make sure that people get paid for content distributed on the internet without turning the internet into Fort Knox, where every bit of content has to be wrapped in very heavy DRM to guarantee that nobody gets access to it except
but then how does that happen? I mean, in some ways, the beauty, if you will, or the ugly beauty, if such a thing exists, of old copyright law was all rights reserved. And therefore, any borrowing is illegal. It's, you know, and then if we end up, you know, sort of having to wrap digital content, and it'll be like obscenity. You know, obscenity becomes like piracy. You know when you see it. But do you really? Are the artists then? Are artists going to have to become the sort of copyright police, chasing down, looking for illegal borrowings?
Well, if you worried about every copy, that's the way the system was calculated. Have to control copies, then yes, I think that's the ultimate result. You need to build systems to control the distribution of copies. And I think that's a reason to try to find a different way to pay artists. I debated Hillary Rosen, and she bemoaned the fact that she said that there's no digital rights management system yet that's enabled content, music, to be shipped across the internet, cross-platform to any system. And that's a real problem with technologists. And I said, what are you talking about? Napster was a system for making every computer get access to content, and Kazaa does that today. The only reason you can't do it under the DRM regime is that DRM is extraordinarily complicated and not yet well worked out technology. So it doesn't work if you've got to control the distribution of copies. But if in the alternative, you had systems for monitoring the usage, download usage, EFF is proposing, for example, a voluntary collective license where people can pay $10 a month or some fee depending on how much effect this has in the market. And if you pay that, then you're free to download using peer-to-peer systems, peer-to-peer really open, no DRM. And so that money then would be used and distributed to artists on the basis of the frequency with which their content is accessed. Now the point about that system is you're paying in some sense. It's not perfect control, but because it's not perfect control, you can use the cross-platform benefit of this internet to spread content.
And these alternative systems that what you're thinking about, there's a chilling precedent. Hummer Winblad, a venture capital firm that backed Napster, was sued by the music industry for doing that, for funding a illicit technology, not the use of the technology, really funding the technology. What other technologies are at risk or could soon be out?
Well, this is the problem with the last, it might be the last 6 years in Silicon Valley, is that when people came up with new technologies for distributing content, the equivalent of the VCR as of our day, rather than the court stepping back and saying, as the Supreme Court said with the VCR, it's up to Congress to re-strike the balance, let's see how it develops, and let's decide what the effective protection should be, given the way the technology is working. The courts have allowed the content owners to go in and basically sue these new technologies out of existence. So Napster is one example. I think the better example is a company called mp3.com, which was producing a technology to enable you to put your CD in your computer, and then the service would recognize the CD and then give you access to that music whenever you signed into your account from wherever you were. So you could sign into your account from home, or you could sign into your account at work. And when you signed into your account, you got access to your music. Now, the reason MP3 wanted to do this is they wanted to be able to collect lots of data about people's preferences so they could begin to recommend new artists to these people. So it was part of a process to enable artists to produce music without having to sign their life over to the label. Well, they were sued, and the court adopted a very simple technique in analyzing the case. And the technique said, well, in order for MP3.com to give access to this music to users who verify that they have the content on their CD, MP3.com had to copy 50,000 CDs onto their database. Well, that's an act of copying, therefore it infringes a copyright. Is there a fair use justification for it? No, it's a commercial entity, so there's no fair use justification for it. So it's a willful copyright infringement by a commercial entity. They were fined $140 million.
Oops.
They were then forced to be bought, maybe that was, you know, basically drug them out of business. They were then bought by one of the companies suing them. And after the company bought them, they brought a lawsuit against the lawyers who advised MP3.com that their idea might plausibly be legal under American jurisprudence. So it's not just that they were suing the venture capitalists, they sued the lawyers, so the lawyers get a very clear mafia.
I like that, sue the lawyers.
Which is, don't you encourage this kind of... So the consequence is this kind of, as Barry the Master calls it, pall. We feel a pall that has fallen into the valley, where people no longer want to innovate in this space because they're afraid of the consequences of these lawsuits, which means that this potential explosion of innovation is chilled, at least to the extent that we can't get the sign up of the major risks.
Right. So, okay. So then, if we're, you know, using, there's in your book, you know, you're critical of the length of copyright terms, and then also the increasing regulation of fair use. What, in your opinion, is the most insane example of this growing of copyright being used to either, you know, control creativity, to lock down culture in your words?
Oh my God!
What's
that insane example? What is the metric of insane? There's the most unfair kind of examples. So there's a guy, Jesse Jordan, who was a student at RBI. And Jesse Jordan was tinkering with a search engine that existed on the RPI network to enable people to search files that were in directories of computers that were connected to the RPI network. And he tinkered with this and made it a little bit better so it wouldn't crash if the machine happened not to be turned on when you tried to get access to a file. And he was running it on his dorm's computer. And he collected an index of about a million files in the RPI network. And you could only get access to these files if you were at RPI. You couldn't get access off the RPI campus. And of the million files, two-thirds to three-quarters had nothing to do with music at all. He's not making money from this. He's doing nothing more than being an amateur Google within RPI. So then he, in April of 2002, receives a lawsuit notification from the RIAA telling him he's engaged in willful copyright infringement. Willful copyright infringement means you're liable for up to $150,000 per infringement. So he was liable, they said, for damages of up to $10 million, given the list of songs that they had that were on his index. So $10 million is what he was exposed, what his exposure was. They said to him, so how much money do you have, Jesse? And Jesse said, well, I've saved $14,000. And they said, okay, fine, we'll settle for $14,000. And Jesse said, I haven't done anything wrong. This is outrageous. I'm not a pirate. All I'm doing is tinkering with the network. I'm building a search engine. It's outrageous. I'm not going to settle. So he talked to his uncle, who's a lawyer, and his uncle told him, well, you know, we could fight. We might even win. It's going to cost maybe $150,000, $200,000 to fight it. So if we fight and win, you'll get a little piece of paper that says, you beat the RIAA, and then you'll get a bill from your lawyer that says, pay your lawyer $150,000, $200,000. So you can choose. Either pay your lawyer $150,000 or $200,000, or pay the RIAA $14,000. That's your money or your life choice that the system creates. Now, what's outrageous about this is I don't believe that any court would have held that he engaged in willful copyright infringement at all. You know, the downloaders are a different question. I don't believe any court would have held him by the law. And they, of course, in some sense, recognize this because they're so quick. Literally, within days, they want to settle the case. But they're using this as a scapegoat. And they insist that this whole battle is about morality, but I don't know what the morality of this scapegoat is. Because they didn't sue Google or Yahoo, they didn't sue RPI itself, they didn't sue anybody else who was running search engines. They picked this to set an example. And by setting an example like this, using these methods, you reveal the weakness of the legal system, which is that there's no simple, effective way for somebody in that position to defend his rights, and the opportunity it gives for the complex, extraordinary damages for a living.
In your presentation, you talked about the Creative Commons and some of the licenses that are available from Creative Commons. Could you maybe just describe a few of them?
Yes, you actually put it better than, you just put it in a way that was really great and would steal your way of putting it.
It's free culture, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Ha ha.
So the way you described it was, in the old world, you know, there was all these uses you can make of copyrighted material without worrying about copyright. The default was essentially all these free uses, and then there are certain uses you knew you couldn't do without violating copyright law. So if you take a book in real space and you copy it and sell copies, that's an obvious infringement of copyright law. That's wrong, but you can read it or do anything wrong with it in the ordinary sense and not violate copyright law. The problem in the internet is that all of those defaults are reversed. So all the ways that we all expect we should be allowed to be using content, making these mashups that we saw here, putting aside the gray element for a second, just the first and the third, making those mashups in a way that enable people to rhythmics and burn culture like that, technically should not be a violation of anything. Yet, if you listen to the argument away, they will say, this is all a violation of copyright law. Trust us, we won't sue you for this. But it's still technically all a violation of copyright law. So what we did with Creative Commons was we tried to find a way to reverse the defaults. Okay, so we tried to find a way to make it so artists can mark their content with simple expressions of freedom. Say, here's the ways you know you can use this work without any trouble at all. It's not dedicating the work to the public domain, because there's some rights that are still reserved, but it's only some rights reserved. It's not all rights reserved. And so that means that when you come across this marked content, you know the freedoms that you can engage with it and use it without worrying about lawyers or asking permission first. And so our objective was to begin to build a kind of layer of reasonable copyright on top of these defaults that were, in our view, reversed from what most ordinary people can. And so we launched this about a year ago, December, and there's now about 1.4 million link backs to these lessons about the web. And we're rolling out lots of new technologies to make it easier for people to mark content. So Adobe is working with us to make it so you can mark any PDF or any Adobe object with the freedoms associated with the Creative Commons license. And to the extent you make it easy for people to begin to express their view about what the reasonable rule is, I think we'll build an internet that is not the extreme.
And are there any limits to what these licenses can be used for? I mean, there's co-publishing, there's music, there's film. Could they be extended to, say, drugs, to medicine?
In principle, you could license anything. They're tuned to cultural stuff, not necessarily patents or something. But they're, in some sense, trying to do for culture what Richard Stallman did in the software. Using copyright to make copyrighted content available in a way that others can rely upon its availability in a context where the world had made it increasingly hard to rely upon access to this.
Sure, and I speaking with some artists, I understand the musicians or writers that it's very appealing from an artistic sense, the idea that art is influenced by borrowing ideas from people who've gone before and appropriating images, imagery, and so forth. But what's the reaction to Hollywood, or by Hollywood, or by the music industry, to these licenses?
Well, when we launched Creative Commons, I did something I don't think has ever been done before and probably won't be done again. We had a party.
Yeah, important people will never throw another party.
And a video first from John Perry Barlow, who's a famous copyright anarchist, hates copyright, thinks it's ridiculous. But John Perry Barlow endorsed Creative Commons by saying that in an unjust world, this is the most just outcome we could have. And then there was a pause, and up on screen came Jack Valenti. And Jack Valenti, too, endorsed Creative Commons because he said, well, if artists want to make their content available according to these freedoms, they ought to be allowed to do it. And in a debate with Hillary Rosen, Hillary Rosen, too, said, Creative Commons is pro-choice, I'm pro-choice. So on the surface, they're all in favor. But we're beginning to recognize that on the surface is different from deep down in the heart of the beast. We had a recent example of a license which was suggested to us by Gilberto Gil, who's the culture minister of Brazil and one of the most famous musicians from Brazil, who wanted us to develop a license. He calls it a sampling license, we'll probably call it a Nash license. It says, you're allowed to take my content and sample it. You're allowed to sample it for commercial purposes, in the sense that a musician samples it for music. So you're just not allowed to make a verbatim copy of my content. Now, he wanted this because he knows there's an extraordinary amount of amazing Brazilian music, which if it were easy for people to sample, they would sample, and that music would be spread much more broadly. So he was eager to get this as a model for spreading Brazilian culture. And you can see how musicians who are in the genre of sampling would also be extremely eager to use and build on this license, because some of the most expensive production costs for samplers are the cost of paying lawyers to clear the rights to sample the content that you want to sample. So Gilles got us to develop this license, Negative Land.
Fuck.
The license was announced. The Wall Street Journal wrote an article about it. Warner Records read about it for the first time. Gilles has a contract with Warner Records. Warner Records told Gilles, no way in hell. We will allow you to release your license content under this kind of license. Now, Gilles is free because he has lots of other content to release in this license. But the point is, there's a particular business model which these record companies have that they're not eager to see it transform. And if you imagine a world where people are free to sample out of other people's music easily, then the business model would have to be transformed. So on the surface, there's endorsement because it's not anti-copyright, in fact, it's fundamentally pro-copyright. But to the extent it begins to enable other ways of doing business that aren't theirs, it's been resisted.
Oops, sorry, that is all I remember.